Thank you for downloading the podcast. It's a literary special this week. My guests were Barbara Taylor Bradford and Philip Pullman. This is Classic FM, and I'm very pleased to say that my guest this afternoon is the award-winning writer Philip Pullman. Philip, welcome to the Culture Club.
Thank you.
You're going to be appearing at the Oxford Literary Festival this Saturday, and it's also the 20th anniversary of the publication of your award-winning trilogy, His Dark Materials. I'd like to know, how did the idea of His Dark Materials come to you? Was it fully formed in your mind?
No, they're not usually fully formed. I mean, it's quite a long book, a story rather than three books. So to have it fully formed would be 7 years of boredom while you wrote it all down, and you know, and tries to be not bored. How it started actually was a lunch with a publisher, and he said, "What are you going to write next?" And I said, "Well, I could do this or that, but what I'd really like to do," I said, the idea coming into my head as I spoke, "is Paradise Lost," because I'd loved Paradise Lost when I was a teenager and doing it for A level. And by chance, so had he, David Fickling, my publisher. Mm. So we sat over the lunch exchanging quotations. And by the time we'd finished lunch, we'd worked ourselves up into such a mutual pitch of enthusiasm for Paradise Lost that we decided that I'd sort of do a version of that. And I didn't know what I meant by that at first. It was something that had the geographical space of the books 1 and 2 of Paradise Lost, which are descriptions of hell, really,
yes,
and the enormous expanse of this terrible wasteland and fire and flame and pitch and so on. So that excited me. But then I came to realise that the theme of this would be the changing of innocence for experience, the end of innocence and the coming of experience. And this was something that I'd been thinking about for a long time in relation to my own adolescence and in relation to the children who I was teaching, who were that sort of age. Mm-hmm. And watching it happen, watching self-consciousness appear in someone, very interesting state, because little children are very unself-conscious, yes, in the way they dance and draw and sing and so on. But around the time of puberty, they begin to be conscious of their bodies and how they're changing, and they get very self-conscious and defensive, and their voices break and so on. And that introduces a sort of self-conscious this into their thinking as well, and they realise that they can't draw as well as the people whose drawings all around, you know, and they can't sing as well as whoever they is the latest thing. So they think they can't do these things, so they stop doing them. So there was that, and there was also the influence of William Blake, whom I have read and thought about for many, many years. And of course, he's all about innocence and experience.
Yes.
So all these things came together, and I realised that here was a story that I could use to say that sort of thing.
So an extremely profitable lunch, for one thing.
Well, yeah.
Was it difficult to write? Do you find the process of writing painful?
No, it's sometimes tedious.
Yes.
Because sometimes you can't think of what to write next, and you just have to sit there until you've found it. Mm. Actually, the best tip anyone's ever given about this point in the writing was Raymond Chandler's advice: when in doubt, have a man come through the door with a gun. And that gets the story going like nothing else. Whether or not you actually have a man come through the door with a gun, have someone new come into the story, someone you yourself weren't expecting any more than the characters were, and that'll get the story going wonderfully well.
Why do you think it's excited children's imagination, and indeed young adults' imagination and adults' imagination, so successfully?
Well, I couldn't have predicted that, and I couldn't have hoped for that, but I'm so lucky that that's happened that way. And I think the reason for it is that the person in the centre of the story, the little girl called Lyra, is herself not sure of what's going on. Not that she exists in a state of puzzlement and wonderment, but that she's trying to do something urgent and desperate. She's trying to rescue a friend from some terrible fate. And in doing this, she gets caught up into a lot of big conspiracies that she doesn't fully understand. So things that might pass over the young reader's head, sort of pass over Lyra's as well, but they're there for older readers to see and take in. And then when people come back to it later on when they are grown up, they see the things they haven't seen before.
Now, this being Classic FM, we asked you whether you had particularly important pieces of classical music that you would like us to play. And I'm delighted, actually. You've chosen the Mendelssohn Octet in E-flat major, which is one of my favourite pieces. What is it about Mendelssohn's music, and the octet in particular, that appeals to you?
Well, it is the most extraordinary piece of music to have been written by someone aged 16. Mm. We think of Mozart as the young prodigy, but actually Mendelssohn knocks spots off him at this age. This is the most extraordinary, wonderful, fresh, lyrical, complicated, grown-up, intelligent, but internally fresh and innocent piece of music. It's a miracle. It really is. And I love it, and I'd never be without it. ¶¶
And that was the third movement of Mendelssohn's Sublime Octet in E-flat major, played by musicians of the Seattle Chamber Music Society. And that was chosen by my guest this afternoon, Philip Pullman. Philip, I've come across a wonderful quotation of yours, which is that stories are the most important things in the world. Without stories, we wouldn't be human beings at all. Who told you stories when you were a small child and excited your imagination?
Well, it was every book I could get my hands on. It was my mother who read to me from those books, including Rudyard Kipling's Just So stories, which I think was the book I learned to read on. But it was my grandfather too. He was a clergyman, and he was a wonderful preacher, but he told stories. I say but, because if you're a preacher, that's a dangerous kind of thing to do, because people don't forget the story. So next year you've got to find either a different story or something, because they'll forget your sermons, but they won't forget the story. But he was full of stories. I think he'd been to see, he was a Victorian, he was born in 1890-something. I think he'd been to see the Buffalo Bill Wild West show when he was a very small boy and been intoxicated by the Wild West and cowboys and Indians and that sort of thing. So we had a lot of those.
Aside from Rudyard Kipling, who else appealed to you as a small child and growing up into adolescence?
I never lost my love of the Moomins.
Oh, Tove Jansson.
Tove Jansson,
oh,
yes.
Wonderful books, yes.
Whom I encountered at Battersea Library when we lived briefly in Battersea. And a library ticket is the greatest present you can give to any child. It really is. My mother took me there and enrolled me, and I found the Moomins there and fell in love with them. The whole atmosphere in which they lived, eccentric, strange, kindly, adventurous, bizarre. So I'm still deep in Moomin land. But I also loved an Australian book called The Magic Pudding by Norman Lindsay.
I don't know
it's
that.
The funniest children's book ever written. It was published in 1916. We came across that because we spent a little time in Australia when I was about 9 or 10. And every Australian child knows The Magic Pudding, so I had a copy of that. And I just loved it. It's funny. The illustrations are superb. Norman Lindsay was principally a graphic artist. And it's just a wonderful book. I was lucky enough to write an introduction to it for the New York Review when they published a series of children's books.
That sounds fascinating. Yeah. I must go and root that out because I didn't know that at all, and I'd like to read it. Tell me about the role of blue tack and small yellow post-it notes in the writing process.
Well, this comes at the planning stage, which does not precede the writing stage, despite what they say in the national curriculum, which ordains that you should make a plan first, and then you should, you know, taking 15 minutes, then you should take 45 minutes to write your story, and then you should present them both and get a mark, and that goes on the school's league table, all that nonsense. Well, I could never work that way around. I write the story first, and then I look at it and see what it should look like. So that's the planning stage. And post-it notes are very good for this, because you can just scribble, you know, Lyra meets Yorick. That's a scene or chapter, so that's a post-it note. And you can put them all on the wall or a big piece of it, and you can move them around. You can say, well, there's a long time between there. We ought to move that, so we move that and join those two. So that's what they do. That's what I do with those.
Fascinating. And do you have a particular place that you write in that you're very comfortable?
Yes, I write in a little room upstairs at the top of the house. I used to have a shed, which I wrote in for years and years, because at the time, this is when I was teaching, and the time I had for writing was also the time that my son would do his violin practice.
Oh, gosh.
And it's not that he became a professional musician. He's very good, but I would listen to that rather than writing. And any music is an absolute killer, as far as I can say, when I'm writing. But it's to do with the rhythm. You have to hear the rhythm of a sentence as you're writing it. And if there's music going on, especially music that you want to stop and listen to, you can't do that. So I had the shed, and I worked in the shed until we moved house, at which point I gave the shed to another writer on condition that when he's finished with it, he passes it on to a third.
Oh, lovely. So it has a continuity.
Yeah.
Well, talking about music and being a distraction while you're writing, I'd like to move on to Bach, which is one of my favourite pianists is András Schiff. And I've chosen the Goldberg Variations, the aria from the Goldberg Variations by Bach. I always assume, because I love Bach so much, that everybody else loves him too and couldn't live without him. Is that true for you?
It certainly is. And Schiff is the most extraordinary pianist, a wonderful range. And the Goldberg Variations, I do love. Variation form is something that even musical amateurs can sort of get a handle on, because you've got the tune in your mind, and you can sort of see what he's doing with this variation or that one and see how it sort of fits. It's a bit like jazz, isn't it? Because you hear the chords underlying this variation or that one in a jazz solo. So the Goldberg Variations I do love, and Schiff is a wonderful pianist.
Well, let's hear Schiff now.
Thank you.
Andras Schiff playing the aria from the Goldberg Variations by Johann Sebastian Bach. I'm Charlotte Green, and my guest this afternoon on Classic FM is the award-winning author Philip Pullman. Philip, you seem to take great pleasure in the physical world, the here and now, and I know that you actually do a lot of work with wood. Physical things appeal to you, don't they?
They do. When you're writing, you're kind of in an intellectual world, and the only connection you have with the physical one is at the end of your fingers, whether you type on a keyboard or write by hand, as I do. And it's such a pleasure to come away from that and engage with something that's physical and heavy and difficult and refractory, like oak or something, and sharpen your chisels and get a, you know, do a bit of sort of craftsmanship. And I love that. I really do.
And work with your hands as opposed to concentrating on the cerebral.
That's right. It's not that you're not being cerebral when you think about a dovetail joint or something. You've got to find expression through the physical and through the way your hands move and the way the tools move and how sharp they are and what you can do with the wood, with the grain or against the grain and all that sort of thing. I love all that.
Do you walk a lot?
I used to, but I've been ill in the last few years. I haven't been able to walk very far. So I sort of stand and stare. That's what I do now.
That's rather what I do at football matches. I'm very interested in sport, but I do a lot of walking, but I tend to watch a lot as opposed to take part in it. What about various other art forms? Is there any art form that you really don't like or can't get a handle on?
Well, I have to say, you know the Tintin books, of course, and you know that character, Signora Castafiore, the ear-piercing Italian soprano. Well, that kind of music, I'm a bit of a Captain Haddock where that sort of music's concerned. So I can sort of
wonderful description.
Do with that
really? You're not.
I'm oddly enough, I'm not very keen on vocal music, not nearly so keen as I am on instrumental music. It might be something to do with the way that you have to produce your voice in order to project in a concert hall or over an orchestra in an opera house. But when the microphone was invented in about 1930, electric recording came in, suddenly you could hear every word that a singer sang, even when they were singing very quietly, crooning.
Yes.
So there's no problem at all hearing what Frank Sinatra or Ella Fitzgerald are singing, what the words are. Mm. But sometimes you could listen to a singer in a piece of opera and you don't even know what language they're in.
That's a very good point.
So that's something that I find a bit hard.
What about ballet or art?
Well, some ballet music is wonderful. Stravinsky.
It's certainly, yes.
Stravinsky's marvellous. And I think I'd probably sort of close my eyes and listen to that rather than
watch the actual ballet. Philip, this has been terrific. I've really enjoyed talking to you. I'm sorry it's been relatively short, but thank you very much for coming in.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Charlotte.
And I should just say that you're appearing at the Oxford Literary Festival on Saturday, the 28th of March.
Charlotte Green's Culture Club on Classic FM.
Well, I'm very pleased to welcome the best-selling author Barbara Taylor Bradford to the Culture Club this afternoon. Barbara, thank you very much for coming in to talk to me.
I'm happy to be here.
And your new book, The Cavendon Women, which I have in front of me, is out this week. And I just wanted to start by asking who or what first kindled your love of words and literature?
My mother. She was a voracious reader and taught me to read by the time I was 4 years old. Oddly enough, I was in a kindergarten school in Upper Armley outside Leeds, and I only found out when we were both grown up that Alan Bennett had been at the same kindergarten Christchurch, Church of England, Upper Armley. And he sort of looked at me and I said, well, he can be a bit brusque, but he is a lovely person.
Yes.
And he said, well, I don't remember you. And I said, well, Alan, I'm sorry, but I don't remember you either, but we were little kids. And she taught me to read and read to me a lot and, of course, got me a library card when I could have one. And when I was 7, I started writing.
Wonderful. And you've never stopped, of course, and you are incredibly successful.
Thank
now, the
you.
New book, The Cavendon Women, it's about four women who come from both sides of the large house. Yes. I suppose you could say upstairs and downstairs.
Well, they're not really, excuse me interrupting you and correcting you, but I don't see them myself as downstairs because there is a downstairs staff.
Yes.
The butler, the cook, the footman, the maids.
They're separate
from... The swans have actually, the swan through many generations have been working with the Inghams, the aristocrats, and started out before the first Earl, who was a simple Mr. Humphrey Ingham. He was like his aide, James Swan, in the 1700s. So when Mr. Ingham became the Earl, he just carried James Swan along with him. And yes. They've stayed there, and they don't live in the house. They live in the village. And the father of Cecily Swan, who is really one of the main characters,
yes.
He's the valet to the Earl, but he's allowed to go home at night because he lives in the village.
Now, you like to write about women who have a drive to succeed in life. I came across a lovely quotation. I write about mostly ordinary women who go on to achieve the extraordinary. Would you say that the four Cavendon women are good role models for young women?
Yes, I think they are. Of course, my greatest role model was Emma Hart,
yes.
From A Woman of Substance. But Cecily Swan has always shown a great talent for making things. Her mother is a seamstress and does work for the counters. So she does become, in Cavendon Women, a very famous designer in London and actually is compared and called the English Chanel. And Dulcie, the youngest sister of the Inghams, is determined to open an art gallery, which she keeps referring to as a shop. And her great aunt says, "Shop? We're not tradespeople." But she really means gallery, and
yes,
she's determined to go to the attics and steal all this stuff that nobody wants, nobody's going to use, amongst which there are some nice pieces of art. And she succeeds in that. Daphne is mostly running Cavendon because Mummy has run away with another man. Deirdre, who is working at the War Office, is... later gets into it and helps in any way she can.
Barbara, let's move on to your first musical choice, because we asked you about your favourite music before we started the interview. And you've chosen Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony. We're going to play the third movement. Why does Rachmaninoff appeal to you?
My mother used to love it, of course. That's when I first heard it, because we had a gramophone. She had a gramophone. It's grand, and yet there's something very romantic about it. I love it. It's got a lot of fluidity to it, and it reminds me of my childhood, I suppose. You know, that's part of it, nostalgia.
Well, let's hear it now. That was the third movement of the Symphony No. 2 by Sergei Rachmaninoff. The Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra was conducted by Vasily Petrenko. Well, I'm Charlotte Green, and I'm joined on Classic FM this afternoon by the best-selling author Barbara Taylor Bradford. Barbara, are you a disciplined writer? Do you have a set routine?
Yes, I am disciplined, and I actually always have been in anything that I ever did. I think it's just something innate. I wasn't taught to be disciplined, it's just there. I always did my homework as a child. My mother taught me to be punctual and disciplined about where I was going and getting there on time. But to be able to write a book a year, which I do, you really have to be disciplined, and you have to have the drive and the stamina too, you know, sit there for a long time. And when I go into my new apartment, there was a lovely library, and I took that as my office because I had so many books. And when I go into that room to write, there's something about it. It's one of those strange things, and I do believe places have atmosphere. There is something about that room. From the moment I entered the apartment for the first time, I loved it. But in that room, there's a calmness. And I wrote that in most of that book,
in that room.
And every morning I'd get up at 5 and go and turn on the coffee pot and get dressed and have my coffee in there by 5:30 and look at what I'd done the day before. And I have to have that discipline.
Of course.
Because it won't get done. Yeah. If you say, I don't feel like it. Sometimes I don't feel like it, but not often, because it's an adventure. Mm. New people I've created, and what's going to happen to them. That's the best part of it, is writing the book. Editing gets a bit tough.
One thing I love is,
of course, coming out and meeting people. And yesterday we had to go somewhere, a women's institute, and they were telling me about the war years because I asked them. And it's given me a lot of ideas for the sequel.
Excellent.
Because the sequel starts in 1938.
So that's ideal.
Yes, so sometimes when I'm out promoting a book, I pick up ideas for the next one.
You're an ambassador for the National Literacy Trust.
Yes.
It's very important, isn't it, that young girls should believe that reading and writing are exciting things to do.
Yes.
I imagine you think that's terribly important.
Well, I think if you can't read, it's a death sentence. If you can't read and you're an adult woman, you're out of step with your children, of course, but you're out of step in everything because you can't even read a label on a bottle of pills or a street name. So I'm very much involved with this National Literacy Trust here because I think we can't have a generation, the next generation, that can't read or write, because where will that take the country? And so I am involved as much as I can. I've gone to girls' schools to encourage them. We came up with the idea of having a writing competition for anybody between 12 and 18 to enter. And I think it's the last entry is in July. I want people, children especially, and young women, to be involved in reading and writing. And the figures are staggering. Mm. And somehow, over a certain age, they don't think it's cool to read.
That's the problem.
Why not? They want to watch television or something, I suppose. So if they're on an iPad, I want them to be reading a book rather than sending a text.
Barbara, thank you very much indeed for joining me this afternoon. The Cavendon Women is out on Tuesday. And I'd like to finish by looking at your second musical choice this afternoon. We've chosen The Stars Were Shining Brightly from the opera Tosca by Puccini. And what is it about Puccini's music that you love?
Again, it comes from my childhood. My mother loved Puccini, and I do think he's lighter in some ways. Mm. It's not such heavy music. And again, it's an opera, and it's romantic and tragic and all of the things that I write about, actually.
Thanks again for downloading the podcast. Next week, I'll be talking to one of the stars of the new Disney film Cinderella, Helena Bonham Carter, and also to the director of the film, Kenneth Branagh. So I do hope you'll join me then.